there's Andrews and Bowers and Kavanaugh, Carson, Bush and Bickelmeyer, Christensen, Bailey, Cruz, Christie, Dummett, Fiorina, Everson, Fellow, Graham, too, Gilmore, Hayden, Rubio, Hill, Jindal and Huckabee, Kasich, Lauer, Martel, Mitchell, Newland, Olivares, Pataki, Paul, Pettyu, Russell, Sherman, Santorum, Trump, Walker, Wilson, Steinberg, Sanders, Voss, Kelso, Webb, Shreflick, Clinton, Caffrey, Giudice, Winslow, Lessig, Brown, Chaffee, O'Malley, Wells, Astor, Carter, Vaughn, Pass. These are some of the declared presidential candidates for 2016. Some. It's only a partial list. The one thing that we can all bet on with each of them, either they will say or they will write in their statement something about family values. And more than half will link family values to Christian family values. It seems that everyone this year is talking in some way about the breakdown of the family. And this is a campaign year, and from my point of view, it's a really long campaign year. So many factors contribute to the breakdown of the family, and some of the reasons we hear in varying shades include there's too many divorces, there's too many teens having babies, there's too many mothers working outside the home, and there's too many mothers on welfare not working outside the home. Too many absent fathers. Poverty destroys the family. Drugs and alcohol destroy the family. Gay people are destroying the family. All the values of family that we grew up with are vanishing. We will hear. But one thing we've not heard, or you've not heard, is that Jesus is destroying the family. Or at least, Jesus is challenging some of our assumptions about the family. Earlier in the third chapter of Mark, before what I read to you, in the very beginning of chapter 3, this wasn't part of the gospel this morning, but it helps us set the scene. This is the very beginning, Mark 3, 2021. Then he, Jesus, went home, and the crowd came together again, so they could not even eat. And when his family heard it, they went out to restrain him, for the people were saying, "He has gone out of his mind." Mark leaves us for a while, which is very much his style, and then he picks up the theme again. And this is what we heard. His mother and brothers came, and standing outside, they went to him and they called to him. And they said, "Your mother and brothers and sisters are outside." And he replied, "Who are my mother and brothers?" What is a mother to do with a son like that? I would have said, "Well, I'm your mother, and what's going on here?" It truly must have been a shock for his family to hear those words. Now, Jesus did say some strange things about families, including his own. He called on people to leave their families. I always felt sorry for Zebedee. You know, Zebedee was in the boat with his two sons. He was working, they were fixing the fishing line, and Jesus said, "Come, follow me." And the two boys went off, leaving the father to do all the work. I did feel, you know, there's a place in my heart for that man. And then at one point, Jesus was calling the people to follow him, and this young fellow went up and said, "Yes, I'll follow you, but first I have to bury my father." And Jesus said, "Well, let the dead bury the dead." Now, that's not only harsh, but if you think about it, it's quite impossible. Today's reading, his mom and siblings come to see him. And Jesus seems to disregard them completely because he looks at the crowd, Mark says, and he says, "Well, here are my mother and brothers and sisters, and whoever does the will of God is my mother and sister and brothers." And some of you, I'm sure, noticed he didn't say Father, because at least in the book of John, there's only one Father, and that Father is God. So what is Jesus saying here? Jesus is saying that these people are as valuable to me, as important to me, as my blood family. He treated people on the margins. He treated outcasts as family. And he called his followers children and little ones. It's very hard to find a traditional Christian family in the teachings and life of Jesus. Indeed, it's very hard to find such families in the whole Bible. And yet we hear so much today about Christian family values that it would lead us to think that we could open to any page in the Bible and find these values lived out. That if we really looked at the Bible, we could name some good, godly families, we would find them. Well, where would you begin? Who would you choose? Think for a minute, who would you choose? In the very beginning, we're told that a man should leave his father, and in Genesis, a man should leave his father and his mother and cling to his wife. Well, that's often read at weddings. There's not one example of that in the entire book of Genesis. We are people of the Abrahamic faith. Us, with the Muslims and the Jews, claim Abraham as a father of our faith. He's central in our faith journey. And yet, Abraham fathered children from two different women, and one, Hagar, didn't have a choice. One son he almost sacrificed, and the other son he threw out into the wilderness. Abraham. And then there's Jacob. Well, Jacob married two sisters, Leah and Rachel. And then he had children by his two concubines, Zilpah and Bilhah. Four different women with them long enough to have children. David, Israel's greatest king. We love David's Psalms. Well, David took Bathsheba for himself because he simply wanted her. He took her to bed, and then he had her husband, Uriah, killed in battle. There is one book in here, the Song of Songs. It's a beautiful love poem. Beautiful profession of love. It's a little book. The man and the woman talk to each other. They celebrate each other's bodies. It is beautiful. The two people weren't married. If you sit down and talk to relatives and they're preparing their wedding, they probably don't think of this, but I, as a pastor, I mean, I've had couples come in and I asked them, well, what text would you like? Well, some of them don't even know what text is, but anyway, we move on, and many of them say, oh, I'll go to that wedding feast of Cana. That's great. You know, that story is not about a wedding. It's about changing water to wine. Now, that'd be a fun thing to happen. Maybe that's why they choose it, but, you know, it's not about a wedding. And our first reading today, that wonderful song of Ruth, you know, entreat me not to leave you. Where you go, I will go. We will die together. It's not between a bride and a groom. It's between Ruth and her mother-in-law. What about love is patient, love is kind? That's gorgeous. Paul's poem, Love. Paul wrote that not to a couple getting married. He wrote that to a congregation that was in total disarray and disruption. So, you know, if you think about this, for most of what I said, you could say, okay, she's talking about irrelevant Old Testament text, ancient times. It doesn't have any bearing. Okay. Surely in the new, we could find some good, godly Christian, surely. Okay, well, who would you choose? Well, there's Mary and Joseph. That's a beautiful story, but really, you know, Joseph did the right thing. He went beyond righteousness and took Mary as his wife. Mary pregnant with a child who wasn't his. And then Joseph disappears. We don't hear anything about Joseph throughout the rest of the New Testament. What sort of a marriage was that? Simon Peter. Jesus cured Simon Peter's mother-in-law. Does that help you? This Timothy. Paul commended Timothy, calls him one of his most beloved co-workers. Well, Timothy had a Greek father and a Jewish mother. It was a mixed marriage. And Timothy was raised by his grandmother Eunice and his mother Lois. They taught him the faith. Timothy was raised by two women. Well, there are two married couples in the book of Acts. Two. One of them, Priscilla and Aquila, were faithful leaders. But then there was Ananias and Sapphira. Now, you know, in the early church, if you sold property, you didn't keep the money for yourself. You turned it in, and the community decided who best needed that money. Well, Ananias and Sapphira sold property, and they said, we're going to keep that money. And they did, and then they fell dead at the apostles' feet like that. Now, I don't think that marriage caused their death, but marriage didn't assure their faithfulness. As strange as it is, it's nearly impossible to find what we would call a traditional Christian family in the Bible. And surely some, including myself, would protest. I would say, well, the Bible isn't like magazines at the checkout counter, you know, seven steps to a perfect love life. I mean, it isn't like that. And you're right, it's not like that. Then why can people be so absolutely certain of what a perfect Christian family looks like? How can we hear in the public debate about Christian family values as though they are so clearly spelled out in the Bible? If we're honest, and I hope we can be honest, our family values, yours and mine, are shaped by many things. By our childhood, happy or tragic, by the different families that we have known, by the community we grew up in, even the countries we were born in, whether or not we have known families different from our own. Now, I was born into an Italian family. In fact, I remember thinking for a time when I was a little girl that everyone was Italian. In fact, if I was a little girl yesterday and put on the U.S. Open, I would have been sure that everyone was Italian. I grew up in a five-story walk-up apartment in West New York, New Jersey, which is not, it's in Hudson County. And our apartment was directly across the street from a Jewish synagogue. I was the little girl who went up and down putting on the lights for them because they weren't allowed to put on lights on Friday night. And then I remember the teens coming in and my mother would let them use the phone in our apartment because they couldn't use the phone in their own. So this was part of how I grew up. Right across the street from where I lived was a little like a luncheonette, and above the luncheonette lived an African-American family, a grandma and her two granddaughters. One of the granddaughters was my friend. I played with her. We used to play stoop ball all together, and there was never anything mentioned, so it was fine. This was how life was for me. There was no prejudice or any of this stuff. To be honest, I didn't recognize color early on. She made me recognize color. So this is how I grew up. And my mom always had sewing projects, and she would take me to New York City, to buy notions, which are things that you use for sewing projects. And I remember I was like 8, 7. And as I walked, I would see many, and especially in the garment district, different types of couples then as well as now. All of this went into shaping my concept of family. And it's the same for you. You know, think, your childhood, families you've known, they form your idea of family values. They influence which families we believe are better than others, and which families we feel are not really good at all. We all have feelings. We all have thoughts. We all have opinions. And it's not morally wrong to have these. It's not morally wrong for the presidential candidates to have them either. But it is wrong to equate our feelings and our opinions with Jesus's values. I can look at a family and might not even be able to escape a feeling and say, oh, that family is a terrible family. But my opinions are not the same as Christian family values. We all know families with a mother and a father and two children, which are very nurturing and loving. And if we're honest, we will also know families with a mother and a father and two children who are badly treated. And we all know families that do not fit the definition, the typical definition, as being wonderful and as being life-giving, that ideal family. We all know families that don't fit that definition. And some of them are wonderful and life-giving. And you know, maybe it's our own family. Maybe it's us. Maybe we don't fit into the model that we've drawn for ourselves. Maybe our children don't fit into the ideal. What could be wrong there is putting words of judgment toward ourselves, perhaps our children, our family, toward others, putting those words of judgment in Jesus' mouth. It wasn't his style in the gospel, and it isn't God's style now. We have to be as humble as Paul being humble. In his letter to the Corinthian church, you know, he says, he starts out, and I'll just read part. He says, to the unmarried and widows, I have it written here, I say it is well for them to remain unmarried. Single people here, to getmatched.com. And then he says, you know, but if you're not practicing self-control, they should marry, for it's better to marry than to be filled with passion. Okay, judge for yourself. But then he says, to the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. Notice already he's differentiating his opinion from God's. And then later on in this chapter, he says, now concerning virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I do have an opinion. I have no command from God, but I have an opinion that's honest and that's humble. We have our right to an opinion, but we have no right to equate it with the will of God. Jesus said many different things about families, including his own. One of the last things Jesus did on the cross was to redefine family. He looked down at the beloved disciple John and his mother Mary, and he said to Mary, Mary, there's your son. And then he said to John, John, there's your mother. And they became family. Jesus didn't diss the family at all. He tried to open it up to a much more expansive view. In many ways, he relativized the importance of family, but he included in his own family people who never, ever would have been included. Something like that happened to the author and poet Ursula Le Guin on a street in New York. She writes this very short poem called On 23rd Street. I don't know if any of you know 23rd Street in New York. It's kind of like the crossroads of humanity. And this is what she says. She looked at me clearly, eye to eye, and said, clearly as if across a dining table. You see, my parents never told me it was the communists. She wore a soiled, hot pink leotard and many other clothes. And many other clothes and other things were in her wire shopping cart. She went on talking, and as I passed, explaining why she was angry. I couldn't understand, and I only thought, oh Lord, if I was her mother and saw her like that, I am her mother, and I see her like that. If we begin to say that our singular family isn't everything, maybe then we can open ourselves up to know that family can include anyone. Jesus expanded the definition of family, and he challenged most of our opinions. And I hope that we can be honest with ourselves and one another, honest to know that family is important, but it may not be the most important thing in the world if some people are not part of it. Following Jesus requires that we challenge our operating paradigm of family, our family and the others. Following Jesus requires that through God's healing grace, that grace that it'll break through that wall that we have and enable us to embrace those we may have considered not to be suitable, not to be suitable enough to be part of our family. May it be so.